Session number 6229, reel 7.
This is Collier reel 7. Your existence at Pelham Balang changed when you were moved to different accommodation. How did this arise? When did you first hear of it?
Well, we got the first hint from the men. The men had built themselves a camp about a mile or two from where we were in the houses. And they occasionally used to be able to get notes up to us, particularly towards the end of our stay in the houses, when they were allowed to chop firewood for us and used to send up some chopped firewood by a lorry, which was a great benefit to us. And, of course, they took the opportunity to secrete messages in the firewood. So we often used to get odd little messages tucked in among the firewood. And on this occasion, there was a message to say that they knew that they were to be moved from the camp, their camp, and they had strong rumour that we also were to be moved, but they didn't know where we were going. And it turned out, of course, in the end, that where we went was to their vacated camp. They were moved to the jail, and we were put in their camp, because I think the reason must have been that by that time the Japs had collected up a tremendous number of extra women that they'd rounded up, mostly Dutch or Indonesians, that they'd rounded up in various parts of Sumatra. And it was swelling the numbers so considerably in our houses that they couldn't literally squeeze any more in. And so I suppose to make room for more, they decided to change us over and put us in the men's, we always called it the men's camp, which of course could accommodate more. And by the time we were settled in that one, that was when the number went up to about 700, which obviously we couldn't accommodate in the houses that we had. And so we were moved into them. They just came round and told us we were to go. And we didn't know where. They never did tell us where. So we had no idea what things to take, whether to take all our pots and pans and tins that we'd collected for cooking and so on, what to take, what not to take. But we always hoped for the best and took as much as they would allow us to take. And so that when we were actually moved by, most of us were taken in lorries and so on, we found ourselves, well, to our dismay, in the men's camp. Now, the men, thinking that they were vacating the camp in order that the Japs could put their men in, had absolutely done everything they could to make the camp as inhabitable as possible.
You mean as uninhabitable?
They had stuffed up the wells, thrown all the rubbish into the wells that they could lay their hands on. They devastated the huts. They'd left filth, and it was absolutely beyond expression, of course, which they would never have done had they known that we were to go there. They would have done the reverse, because they would have cleaned it up for us. But not knowing that it was we who were going there, thinking that it was going to be Japanese who were going to be put in there, they'd absolutely done their damnedest to make it as uninhabitable as possible. So we were faced then with this task of clearing the camp up from the men's rubbish. And it was really quite unintentional on their part. They would never have done it to us, of course, obviously. So that was our first effort. We had to clear all this stuff out of the wells. I think there were one or two wells, and they were very precious because we needed the water. And cleaning up the latrines and the hutments and everything. It was dreadful. It was so awful, because in the houses we'd made ourselves, well, as comfortable as we could, and obviously we'd kept the place clean. And here we were faced with these filthy places. Now, these were Attap huts that held about 58, 60 of us to the hut. They were just Attap, which is the palm leaves, thatching, and wooden sides. And the sleeping accommodation was just shelves, well, literally shelves, about, I suppose, 2 feet above the ground level. And the whole place was muddy. Even in the huts it was muddy, because it was only stamped mud. The huts were built on mud, and so it was just muddy underfoot. And there was just a space underneath the bed space where you could push things, and there was a shelf at the back of the foot of the space where we could also put a few things. And we just had to take up a space, and worked out at about 28 inches each. and just bed down on these slats. I must say, as far as I was concerned, it was a wee bit softer than the tiles, because all the time we were in the bungalows, we were sleeping on the tiled floor, and tiles are so terribly hard, which I didn't say at the time, but I was bruised from my knees to my hips on both sides through lying on the tiles, because every time you moved on these hard tiles, it just caused bruising. We were all bruised all over through lying on these tiles. Well, although we were then lying on wood, at least it didn't feel quite as hard. We hadn't got any bedding, but at least it didn't feel quite as hard as the tiles. But I think that was only about the only advantage. And then the Japs themselves decided to put the Dutch on one side and the rest of us on the other side. It was, the huts were put round a quadrangle, and there were literally four rows of huts, two main rows opposite each other, and then there was the guardhouse on the third side, which made a division and divided those huts into two parts, and the one part nearest the Dutch was given over to them, and the part nearest to us, because there were fewer of us, we turned that shorter hut into the hospital space. Because once we got into the men's camp, they no longer allowed people to go into the town to the hospital there, which they had done before. Anybody who was very sick or needed dental treatment and so on had been taken to the hospital in the town before, which was run by the nuns. But once we got into the men's camp, that was stopped. So we had to provide all our own medical attention. And by the time all these people were drafted in, we'd had four doctors then. One was a German, and the others were English, well, Scottish and English.
One was a German?
One was German, yes.
How did you manage to get a German doctor?
I don't know. She was Jewish, and I think this was the reason that she didn't wish to know anything about repatriation, because obviously she didn't want to be repatriated to Germany. And so I think she had rather a problem. She'd been in Singapore practicing, and I think the problem, or in Malaya, I'm not sure, but obviously it was a problem for her. Although she should have been due for repatriation, she obviously didn't wish to be repatriated. And at first, for quite a while, she was in a bit of a privileged position, because I think the Japs realised that, of course, she wasn't actually an opponent of theirs. She was almost an ally, as it were, and yet an ally who didn't want to be sent back to her own country. So she was in a more privileged position than the others, and anything that she could get or anything that was available, she was able to work for her benefit and for the benefit of the patient she was treating. And so she was just in a slightly better position. But I can't say, we were not very fond of her, I'm afraid.
Why was that?
And she was neither fish, flesh, fowl, nor good red herring, as it were. And we weren't very fond of her at all, but there you are, she was a doctor.
Was the part of the problem that although she wanted to disassociate herself from the Nazi regime in Germany, that the other people in the camp weren't entirely able to make that same disassociation?
No. I mean, she was, as far as we were concerned, she was German, which she was. And I think as far as her sympathies went, probably, she was against us. I don't think her sympathies were with us exactly, despite the fact that she didn't. Although when she was released, I did hear she married an Englishman, a baronet, actually. So perhaps her sympathies were more with us than I thought. But anyway... She more or less was in charge of the hospital as the general factotum at the hospital, and the other three doctors divided the other things. They ran a clinic. They had to set up a sort of clinic then, so that people who were not well could go to them first to decide if anything could be done. And then they had the other two going round the wards, huts, to see if anybody was laid low without having reported sick. Because, of course, just like doctor surgeries at home, you went to the clinic if you were able, but if you were running a fever or anything, you couldn't get to the clinic, so you might be lying on your bed space unnoticed. And some of the things that had to be done where you were lying. So these other doctors used to go around the wards visiting And then the nurses, of course, were much more organised in this camp. And we tried to release them from most of the other camp chores so that they could do what they were trained to do, the nursing. And but, of course, they were no better off financially than the rest of us. They hadn't any money either. And so on the side, they were, the Australians anyhow, were, well, all of us in a way, we were all trying to make money, which was only a very little at a time, by doing things for other people, because there was still money in the camp. There's no equality even in a camp, which seemed very strange to me. And if people ever talk to me about equality, I will say, well, even in our prisoner of war camp, there was no such thing as equality even there, where you'd have thought we were all in the same boat. But of course, obviously, some of the, especially the Dutch, had come in with money. They'd had more opportunity. I expect had we in Singapore had the same chance, we probably would have had more money than the people coming in there. We would obviously have been on our home ground. But they had money, or they had more things to sell and more jewellery and perhaps more valuables that they could keep selling. And so there was money in the camp, but not that many of us on the English side had it.
Before we go on with that, just going back to the health question, did health deteriorate in the Attapats?
Yes, it deteriorated sharply. I think probably because by this time, obviously, we'd had nearly 2 years of living on a very low diet, and it was beginning to take its toll. So by the time we got there, obviously, we were not in the same state physically that we had been. And also, we'd had a lot of complaints. I mean, personally, I had dysentery quite soon after I got into the camp, and I lost 2.5 stone just having dysentery. And we were interned in February, but in May I had dysentery and lost 2.5 stone in the process. Well, that's a lot, which, of course, I never could make up. And other people the same. We'd had, you know, quite a number of odd illnesses, and there'd been quite a lot of tummy upsets all the time, which had taken their toll. And now, of course, as I say, we were in a considerably weakened state, and the conditions were worse, and the food got no better. In fact, it got worse. And there was less chance of black marketing in this camp, in the houses. There'd been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing through the barbed wire. And also the man had been allowed to come in and sell us things. Well, that was stopped. And things were tightened up considerably. It was much more like a prisoner of war camp in the hut.
Yes. So what happened health-wise then?
Well, gradually we got worse and worse. And so people then, we began to find that people were dying. And a lot of people started to die in this camp. And this was a bit complicated because they didn't always let us go out at once and bury them, because obviously in a climate like that, burials normally take place the same day. And they didn't always let us do that for some reason, whatever their reasons were. And because, of course, the danger of having a body lying about, couldn't have it in the hospital, obviously, and we had nowhere to put it. And in this, well, not exactly in the centre, but in the quadrangle that was in the centre of these huts, there was an ATAP shelter where we could sit and shelter from the sun. And I know on one occasion, more than one occasion, we had to just put the body there. And one woman who died, her body was there for a day and a night. Well, then we made a roaster and we did 2 hours on to guard the body, because you see there were rats and marauding animals. It was an awful thought, you know. We couldn't bear the thought, so we just did a guard over the body in twos, just all night and while it was there. And so that was a bad case when they left it there so long, but they just wouldn't let us go out to bury it. And then when, of course, we had to do the burials, we had to take it out and scratch a grave as best we could. There was a Chinese cemetery, and that was where we took them to, the outskirts of a Chinese cemetery, but we still had to dig the graves. And of course, we were not really grave diggers or able to dig graves. Sometimes I'm afraid they weren't buried under very much earth, But we always gathered, because it was outside the camp, and on the way with a coffin, we always picked as much green stuff as we could to put over the coffin. I don't know, there was a sort of an instinct that we wanted to cover it up. I suppose partly, of course, they were only, well, we would call them, I suppose, orange boxes, because sometimes there were big big gaps in the wood that made the coffins. And, you know, we were anxious to cover it up as best we could, and we used to strew it with green stuff from the trees, or if there were any wildflowers growing, we'd pick them and put them onto the coffins in a pathetic effort to make some sort of a covering. And as I say, we buried them as best we could, and there were quite a number of people who died.
Did you try to give them service?
Pardon?
Did you try to give them a burial service?
Oh, yes, there was always a burial service, always, because, you see, we had the missionaries, and there was the church, there was the Catholics on their side, there was the Reverend Mother, who could conduct Catholic services, and we had our missionaries. They were Presbyterian, but, I mean, they could, which is very much allied to Church of England, and they always read a burial. So one of them always went and read a burial service. And always as many friends. And of course, the Japs wouldn't always let a number of us go out. It depended how they felt about it. But those of us who were friendly with the person who died would go out. We gave them as decent a burial as we could. Mm. And then one of the girls in the camp always made a rough wooden cross, even if it was only a couple of pieces, you know, taken from a tree, and put some sort of mark on it. I think she did. She marked it in some way in the hope that, you know, it would be a permanent memorial. But I understand that although they have tried to trace these graves, they've never been able to do so, because it's very much overgrown. In a climate like that, of course, it just gets overgrown. Mm-hmm. They have tried. The War Graves Commission were asked about it, but they couldn't find any of the graves. Mm. Because we stripped them of all their rings, despite the fact that some people said, oh, leave their rings on. And we knew that if there was a suspicion that we were leaving jewellery on their fingers, the graves would be just deprecated by the locals or by the Japs themselves. So we always stripped them of their, made sure that they knew that we'd stripped them of their jewellery. Mm. There was an odd thing about this, though. As people, more people realised that their health was failing, and there was always this possibility that, you know, do I survive or don't I? And gradually people began to make wills on scraps of paper and so on. And if they died and there was nothing to show to the Japs that they'd made a will, they would take everything that was left. They would take it. How they ever could justify this, I can't understand. You know, what justification they had for taking themselves anything that was left, as if, you know, that they had a perfect legal right to it. So, of course, when we found this out, we were so annoyed that we thought, well, if I die, at least they're not going to have what I leave. I'm going to make sure that I make a will so that somebody in the camp benefits, because after all, we were the people who needed it. We needed their jewellery to sell for food, and we needed their clothes. We had so few clothes. In fact, it was a bit upsetting, really, because I've noticed that in my diary, I've, you know, made a very emphatic note about it, because it was very upsetting. You know, a friend of yours would die, and immediately people would gather round as soon as the breath was out of her body and say, oh, she's got a blouse. Could I have that? I haven't got anything to wear. And could I have her neck? Has she got a sheet? Has she got this? And can I have this? Can I have that? And the next day you'd see them in the things that the person only the day before owned. It was, you know, awful. I used to say, oh, the vultures have gathered. Mm. Although, this is it. You know, it's surprising what happens when you get to that low state where every single shred of material counts, and every single article counts, and every single thing that can be flogged counts. I mean, a friend of mine died, and she had taken her, she'd struggled with her suitcase to take it in. Well, I sold that and her shoes, which didn't fit me. She took a larger size than I had. I immediately sold them and ate them. And the case and everything that was saleable that we could get rid of or get any money for, we sold.
Sorry, you said you ate them.
I what?
You ate them.
Well, ate the money. change the amount, you know. I always used to say I ate my gold watch. I used to say I sold my gold watch and I said I ate it. And I had from somewhere I'd acquired a sheet during the time, and not I didn't take it in with me, but somehow or other I'd acquired a sheet, and I think I bought some material or something and made it when we could buy material, and I sold half of that. I cut it in half and I promptly ate that. I had a sovereign and two half sovereigns, and I ate those. Mm. You know, this is how we used to say, well, I'm going to eat my ring, I'm going to eat this. You know, it was the only thing to do.
Yeah.
And one of the doctors, it was quite true, I thought she was a bit harsh at the time, but she said, I've got no patience with people who die with valuable rings on their fingers. And you see, most women were sentimental about their rings. They were sentimental about their wedding rings and their engagement rings. It wasn't so much the value, but it was sentiment. And, you know, they felt, I can't part with this, I can't part with this, not until the last minute. And the trouble was, people didn't recognise when their last minute was. You know, they didn't realise that perhaps if they'd sold it and eaten the food they could buy, they would have saved their lives, because, you know, who knows when that moment comes.
Mm.
And so quite a number, it was quite true. I mean, it sounded terribly harsh when this doctor said it, but it was true. She said she got no patience with people dying with gold, with valuable rings on there. Mm. And another friend of mine who had a beautiful solitaire diamond, and she clung to that. But you see, she died. And I took that ring home to her husband, who survived. And I felt terrible, because I handed to him a beautiful solitaire diamond and her wedding ring, and I felt instead of his wife, I was handing over her rings. And it literally, I think, was true that had she sold this very valuable diamond, it was a beautiful solitaire that had been brought through from a merchant in Singapore, and it was really quite a valuable one. But had she sold that and started to eat at the time when she was going downhill, I think she might have saved her life. Mm, so it was really terrible to think that this man, instead of his wife, got her rings back.
Were the majority of these deaths that began to occur due then basically to starvation?
Well, yes, malnutrition. I mean, really, malnutrition. We were having food, but it wasn't nourishing enough. We weren't getting the right sort of food. And the rice, you get rice, but it's not nutritious enough as a sole diet. We weren't getting enough vegetables. We weren't getting enough green things. And the sort of things we were getting, you know, weren't nourishing enough. We're getting so little meat, so little protein. And then, of course, with constant diarrhea and beriberi sets in, most of the people, a lot of them died of beriberi. And so that, you know, it was just, but of course the main, we didn't lose as many people in this penultimate camp. Well, this was the third camp. We didn't lose as many people in this as we did eventually when we went back to Muntok, because that was fever ridden, and then people started dying of fevers.
Yes.
But it was getting pretty bad. In this camp, I got jaundice. And you see, I don't know, how does one get jaundice? I think it was probably a chill, it might have been a germ, I don't know. But anyway, I had jaundice, and that doesn't do you any good at all.
Mm. Can I just be clear about this? Did the deaths increase when you moved to the Attap huts as a consequence of gradual deterioration over a long period, or do you think the majority of deaths occurred because conditions deteriorated sharply when you moved here?
No, I think it was more because we had got pretty low. It was just a gradual lowering of everybody's resistance to anything over the well, by that time it was 2 years, on very low diet and poor conditions and so on. And I think gradually people's resistance was being lowered to anything that might crop up. Mm. And we just hadn't got anything to fight it with. And of course, some people were not all that strong when they went into camp, and obviously they would succumb faster than the people who'd gone into camp as very fit people. And I think I noticed that people who'd had very serious operations in their past, you know, they'd talked about what sort of health they'd had, and when I had this done and so on. And it did seem to me that if people had had serious operations in their past lives, abdominal operations or anything like that, they seemed to be among the early deaths. People who were anemic in their previous existence, you can call it that, seemed also to suffer more quickly. So I think that the people who went in perhaps very healthy were able to survive a bit longer than people who'd had a history of poorer health.
Makes sense.
I mean, this is obvious, logical, isn't it?
Really? You were mentioning earlier that in the struggle to gain, to get money so as to be able to buy more food, that you were all trying to earn it by various kinds of services. What kinds of things would you do to earn money?
Well, now, you see, there were obviously jobs to be done about the camp which had to be done. And you remember I said that it was mostly done by volunteers. Volunteers, you know, on the not the you and you type, but rather hoping that people would feel it was their duty to do these things. And, of course, they obviously had to be done. The lavatories, the cesspools had to be cleared out. And in this camp, there was no outlet. And the only way to clear these septic tanks was literally for the stuff to be lifted out physically by people into kerosene tins and then taken away and thrown away somewhere. So the tanks had to be cleaned literally by hand. Then the toilets, the drains, which were used as toilets, they were literally only drains, but they'd got to be swilled down and swept through every day or two or three times a day. The bathroom space, which was only an open space, that had got to be swilled with as much water as we could spare and swept down with these stiff brooms. And the camp had to be kept tidy, and any rubbish had got to be burnt and so on. Mm. And so there were all these tasks that had to be done. Now, the people with money, especially the people on the Dutch side who'd got money, as long as they could, they were willing to pay people to do these things because they didn't want it. If they could afford to pay for somebody, if they felt they could and get out of these jobs, then they did so. So people who felt that they could do it. Then there started up a great yen for learning languages. So people who could teach, especially the Dutch, a lot of the Dutch wanted to learn English. So quite a number of us started to teach English to the Dutch, held Dutch conversation lessons and teaching them English grammar and so on. And they paid us for that. And then some of our girls were very clever at making these sort of sun hats against the sun out of the fish baskets that they brought in. We would scrub off these fish baskets and scour them and put them in the sun and go on until the smell had gone off, and then turn them into hats. Well, some of our people, seemed to be mostly our people on our side, they'd learned how to do this, and they would sell those. And then there was another girl who was very clever at making odd things, shorts and brassiers and so on, which the people were willing to buy. And then some of the Australians used to do cooking, because although we did main cooking for the whole of the camp, if you'd got any extras that you could get, the shop came in once a week, and that was a different arrangement from the one before. And if you could buy some little extra things, then they were cooked up separately. Well, these girls, a lot of the Australian sisters used to do that, cooking up various things, because it meant making a separate little fire and perhaps sometimes things that had to cook for hours and hours, and then they would sell that. So all this sort of thing and chopping wood, and then, of course, doing the duty in the kitchens where the of doing the vegetables. And when the vegetables came in, they'd all got to be prepared, thoroughly washed, looked over for insects and so on, and thoroughly washed and prepared, and that sort of, all that kind of thing, just the camp chores.
Which otherwise the Dutch would have had to share,
yes,
to have
they,
shared
well,
in.
Of course, they. I'm not saying that none of them did anything. Mm. That would be unfair. But a lot of them who had enough money were prepared to pay to have these things done. Mm. Yes.
In what way did the arrangements change here, as far as the shop was concerned? You've just mentioned the
yes.
shop.
Yes. Well, this man used to come in and bring us in. Well,
sorry,
we could.
What man?
Oh, well, in the huts. When we were in the bungalows, the houses, he was an Indian. No, he was a Chinese. His name was Go Leng, that's right. And he used to bring an ox cart in, and he'd bring all sorts of things. And you could order from him, even shoes, well, you know, sandal things, trompers and wooden sandals, and like the Chinese wear. And a material sometimes where we were able, and some reels of cotton and pencils and exercise books for a time, you see, when we were in the houses. Well, now that was all cut out, and when we got into the men's camp, it was only food. Well, it was fruit mainly fruit. So we could no longer get materials or anything extra like that. All that we could get was fruit, really, fruit and vegetables. And so in that way, we were cut off from the supplies of, even if we could afford to, buy anything extra. We could only, this used to come in once a week, and we couldn't, well, we used to ask him to if we were particularly the things that we needed, but he couldn't always get them. And things like limes and bananas and